Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, good evening, good evening, and welcome everybody. Today is February 23rd, 2023, and here we are, West Side Visions on Blog Talk Radio with Brother Tony Bullock and Sister Eileen Reed. Sister Reed, are you there?
I am here. Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to the show.
All right, young lady, how was your day today?
It was a very busy day, but it was a very pleasant day. I had a research to do. I was working on some things for our Fresno Freedom School, so it was a very, very good day.
All
and
right.
How was your day?
You know what? I cannot complain. I had a very, very easy day, and, dealing with Mom and keeping me busy, everything worked out good.
Well, that's good. All right, then.
Now, you know, last Tuesday, we had a great show talking about those in Black history who sometimes get overlooked. And, we got so deep into it that we're going to do a second part tonight and finish up discussing those who have made a change out there, who have put an imprint on Black American history and American history.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm really excited about this show. It's funny, listeners, when Brother Bullock and I start working on a project, we usually wind up in the same place without even talking to each other about it. So some people would call it creepy. It's just that we've known each other for a long time. And when it comes to Black history and Black issues, we usually think along the same lines. So that's why this show is taking two parts, because
It just worked out that way. And it is funny how that mind line kind of works together. It just falls into place.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, Brother Bullock had posted something on Facebook this afternoon, something that I'm going to be talking about tonight, and I had to, send him a text and say, you got to get out of my head dealing with this stuff, because, I plan on talking about this particular thing on the show tonight. And
yeah,
little
and,
did
and
I
know. So am I. We're both going to combine it and talk about it together.
Yes. So do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
Yeah, with that being said, go right ahead and start us off, Sister Reed.
Okay. Well, the first thing that I wanted to talk about, because I'm kind of thinking of these shows as this particular show, part one and part two, as hidden figures in Black history. And so I'm going to jump in and start talking about the Buffalo Soldiers. And some of you may have heard about them, but I'm just going to give an overview and let you decide for yourself if you remember learning about these brothers. So the Buffalo Soldiers were given this name by the Plains Indians based on their curly hair and their fearsome fighting style. The Buffalo Soldiers were made up of the segregated 24th and 25th Infantry, we're talking Army Infantry, and the 9th and 10th Cavalry, also U.S. Army. The Buffalo Soldiers were the first park rangers of the National Park Service, and the most famous, well, I'm saying famous, he's little known to many of us, the most famous Buffalo Soldier was Charles Young. And Charles was born in 1864, to formerly enslaved parents, and he passed in 1922. But Charles Young graduated as the third black cadet at West Point in 1889, and he was commissioned as an officer. So after serving 5 years at various posts out west, it just so happened that Young taught at Wilberforce University in Ohio. He was a professor of military science and tactics, along with French and mathematics. And it just so happened that W.E.B. Du Bois was also on faculty there, and Du Bois and Young became lifelong friends from the fact of them both serving on the faculty at Wilberforce. I also want to add that in 1903, Charles Young served as the commander at the Presidio of San Francisco. And you have to understand, listeners, that this is big stuff in 1903 for this black man to be the commandant, the commander at the Presidio in San Francisco. So a lot of people forget that, you know, the Presidio is not just like a national park now or some place to visit, a highlight of San Francisco. It was actually a military base.
Yes,
so,
it was, and my parents were stationed there.
Okay, so with that, I'm turning that over to Brother Bullock.
Well, yes, the Buffalo Soldiers were formed right after the Civil War and were active up until World War II, and they were formed at Fort Leavenworth, 1866. And as Sister Reed said, it started with six regiments, which got cut down to four. And those four we have come to know, the 9th and the 10th Cavalry and the 24th and 25th Infantry. Now, out west here, when they start sending the Buffalo Soldiers this way, the only base to house all four units was good old Fort Huachuca, Arizona, which is almost 150 miles outside of Phoenix, Arizona. And yes, I've had the pleasure. When I was stationed in the air cab at Fort Ord, we used to fly down there. That was the quarters. We would go to Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And my dad also did time there when he got his first sergeant stripes. That was one of the first places he got to visit. Now, when it comes to our Buffalo Soldiers, the 25th had spent time in Vermont, Kansas, and Hawaii.
Wow.
And the 9th came in after fighting in the Spanish-American Civil War before being sent over to the Philippines.
Interesting. Interesting. I did not know that that they served in that Philippine War. Wow. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yes. The 10th came in from Vermont in 1913 to beef up border security.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here it is, what, 2023? And what's one of the big things that Republicans whine and cry about?
Yep, that border.
Border security.
Yep.
But in 1913, that was the first reason for them bringing out the 10th from Vermont to beef up border security and border support. And even before then, in the mid-1890s, Buffalo Soldiers guarded stagecoaches, and they helped out settlers against Indian attacks and against those stagecoaches being robbed by outlaws.
Right.
So they pretty much.
During that time. Wow.
Yeah. Wells Fargo was running stagecoaches, and pretty much Buffalo Soldiers were responsible for protecting them and making sure that goods, passengers, and supplies got through with no problem.
Wow.
1916. That's awesome. 1916, the Buffalo Soldiers entered Mexico with General John Blackjack Pershing.
Okay.
To hunt down and capture Pancho Villa.
Get out of here. That's,
yes.
Wow. That's important information that Black folks need to know.
Exactly.
Yes.
Also, during this same time frame, that particular those particular regiments got caught up in a battle, the Battle of Ambos Nogales, which was started by some German instigators who were hiding out in Mexico, and that was August 27th, 1918. And, of course, the Buffalo Soldiers came out victorious.
Yeah.
Because in this particular battle, in this particular battle, they had help from the Indians who had came to know them and had set up a rapport with them.
Wow.
And it was one of those things where, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. It was like, hey, we have our moments, but they do look out for us, so we're looking out for them.
Right, right. It's not something. That's awesome.
A beautiful thing. And the oldest known Buffalo soldier was Mark Matthews, who at the age of 111 was buried at Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors.
And well, he should have been.
Yes, indeed.
Well,
because this man not only served in the military, but as quiet as it is kept, the Buffalo Soldiers were very prestigious. The Buffalo Soldiers came out west and basically changed history. Like I was saying earlier today, you will always see movies and the cavalry come swooping in and they're all white. Unless, of course, you saw the movie Sergeant Rutledge.
Right.
Woody Strode. But for the most part, their contributions were kind of overlooked. And like you said, they were the first national park rangers.
And that is big doings because they did a lot. They cleared trails. They marked trails. People who were acting as bandits and so forth. So they were the police force, and they did it all in the national park when they started. So that's not an easy job. And I know you, having worked at a national park, you understand, you know, the gigs that they had to do, the jobs that they had to do to keep those parks safe.
That's true. I worked for the Youth Conservation Corps in the mid-70s, and I will never forget working in Sequoia National Forest and having to hike up into the backcountry, and it was like 6 miles up and then 6 miles down on the backside into an area that when it opened up, you know, this is how you know there's a God, because it was so beautiful. It was ridiculous.
Right.
And to see all these wild horses and bears and pumas and, you know, but these men, like you said, go ahead.
Brothers had to be tough to do that job.
Yes. Yes, because think about the Grand Canyon, which by that time was a national area. They had to go in there, and during that time, the Grand Canyon had some spots where bandits were holding up because, you know, they robbed somebody, and then they'd ride off into these different hideouts where they didn't think nobody would look for them. But they had to go in and smoke these people out so that they could make it safe for people who were visiting the parks or, you know, riding the rapids and the rivers, things of this nature.
This is not something, you know, Brother Tony, listening to you talk about this reminds me of something that I did in the early 90s. I spent almost 10 years doing performance poetry and with a group called Ebony Verses. And one of the gigs that we had here locally in the San Joaquin Valley was doing original poetry of enslaved people at the Civil War reenactment. Well, it was about 4 or 5 years in to us doing this yearly gig that we actually got some Buffalo soldiers who were able to work with us on this, and it was, I cannot tell you the source of pride. Reenactors, I mean, they're spending their own money and their own efforts to come in costume and play this part for a weekend. And those brothers were just awesome. You know, I haven't done it for many years now, but I'm hoping that Buffalo Soldiers are still out at, you know, the Civil War reenactment if it continues to happen at Kearney Park. So this is important history, and I really hadn't thought about it for a long time, the part that I played as a reenactor, but when I saw Buffalo Soldiers, I felt so much better because for the first 5 years, it was just me and my other sister poets who were out there as reenactors. So we might have had one or two people playing Harriet Tubman or Frederick Douglass, but Buffalo Soldiers were actual soldiers. They had their rifles, they had their horses, they had their tents, and it was just awesome. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
It's one of my highlights of the Rose Parade every year is seeing the Buffalo Soldiers on horseback in that parade. And like you have said before, it is important to know your history.
So important. You know, it's funny, after, you know, you and I spoke about the Buffalo Soldiers, what I had researched for tonight kind of connected, and I was like, well, this is kind of weird, because the next item that I'm going to talk about, when it's my turn, is also tied to the military, and I didn't really realize that when I was going through all these things, because listeners, for those of you who don't know me, different things pop in my head, and I just kind of run with it. So, so you'll see where I'm going with this when I introduce my next area here. Let me know when it's okay for me to go, Brother Tony.
Well, since you're already on it, go right ahead.
Okay. All right, if you're sure. Okay, because I actually had researched this first. And it was about, and I know this, the Deacons for Defense and Justice. These were brothers who were, most of the Deacons of Defense were veterans of with combat experience from the Korean War and World War II. And so the area that I'm jumping to now is the Civil Rights era, everybody. So the founding members of the Deacons of Defense are Ernest Chili Willie Thomas and Frederick Douglass Kirkpatrick. They formed the Deacons of Defense in November of 1964 to protect civil rights workers and their families from the KKK. This was during the summer, some call it Freedom Summer, in Jonesboro, Mississippi. And rights workers were often targeted. CORE had established, the Congress of Racial Equality had established a place called Freedom House, which was attacked quite frequently, as well as local churches. And so the Deacons of Defense decided that they had enough. And so they were armed with actual rifles and pistols and were ready to defend churches and the meeting house of these activists. So that was in 1964. A sister by the name of Coretta Jackson, she served as the treasurer for that first initial Deacons of Defense that was formed in Jonesboro, Mississippi. In 1965, the Deacons of Defense traveled 300 miles to the mill town of Bogalusa, Louisiana, to organize a new chapter. And that chapter was headed up by Bob Hicks, Charles Sims, and A.Z. Young, who were workers at that Crown Zellerbach plant, and it led to a new chapter. Now, the Deacons of Defense also wanted to establish a Chicago chapter, and it was formed in 1965 by Ernest Thomas, but their initial plan was to spread the Deacons throughout the North and the West, but they were unsuccessful at this. And some historians have said that it was because the tactics that they used were just less effective outside of the South. And we have to know, of course, the FBI went after them, and they did that. The FBI did that because they served as a symbol of power and pride and refuted the stereotype of black submission. So think about it, folks. We're talking about another group, much like the Black Panthers, that decided that they were going to do armed resistance and armed protection of the people in that area of Mississippi and Louisiana. And I believe that they were called Deacons of Defense because Ernest Thomas, one of the founders, was in fact a Pentecostal minister. So I am really proud to be talking about these brothers, and I know, Brother Tony, that you know a little bit about the Deacons of Defense. So
yes, they stepped forward and protected those under their watch.
Yes.
And when you talk about the Deacons of Defense, it just makes you realize how the young brothers out of SNCC who helped form the Panthers, mm-hmm. what they had in mm-hmm. their mind, what thought they had.
Exactly.
Because I have no doubt that they used these gentlemen as a blueprint.
Oh, yeah. Oh yes, I'm sure that they did. And we have to remember, folks, that these are seasoned veterans. These are folks who saw battle and understood what they needed to do. And it was just too much for me to actually list all the confrontations that they had. But these are people who would load their rifles and their pistols in front of the KKK. And actually have the KKK disband and move off because they were there. That's powerful.
Exactly.
These brothers
they were willing to put it all on the line for their people.
Absolutely.
And while we're at it, if you're out there listening, while
mm-hmm.
you're out there listening, you know, our call-in number is 563-999-3043.
Yes, indeed. So we hope we get some callers, because this is important stuff. Deacons of Defense. Whoa.
Oh, yeah. They stood.
Yeah, they did. So what you got, Brother Tony?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to bring to you Gordon Parks, who was one of our most prolific figures behind the camera, black or white. His photojournalism from the 40s through the 70s captured the aspect of American life issues like civil rights, poverty, race relations. Gordon Parks was that brother that you put a camera in his hand and it was like Picasso at work.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first African Americans on Life magazine staff. And of course, he worked with Ebony, Glamour, and Vogue. He co-founded Essence magazine in 1969. And in that time, he became the first African American to write and direct a major Hollywood feature film.
Hello.
And I remember seeing it when I was at Irwin, and I know you saw it. It was called The Learning Tree.
Mm-hmm. Great movie.
Which was semi-autobiographical. And then his next film, which was Shaft, actually changed Hollywood and saved, to be honest, it saved Hollywood, because Hollywood had reached a point to where they weren't making any money off their usual movies their tap dancing movies, their musicals, their little dramas, none of that was selling. And
right.
Gordon Parks gave us Richard Roundtree in Shaft. And that was the beginning of the black exploitation era.
And I do believe that the theme for Chef won an Academy Award. I might be just tripping,
it
but I think
it did win an Academy Award. The theme from Chef was given to us by Isaac Hayes.
That's right. That's right. I got excited. Go on.
And, you know, the thing about it is, and, you know, a lot of people downplay it, but Hollywood really owes people like Gordon Parks, Richard Roundtree, Isaac Hayes, Pam Grier, Roosevelt Grier, Fred the Hammer Williamson. They owe them a debt of gratitude. Red
they
Fox.
Yes.
Because
Cotton Comes to Harlem. That's where
Cotton Comes to Harlem with Coffin Head and Grave Digger Jones.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yes.
Was a great movie.
These are iconic figures, folks, for those of you who don't know who, you know, we're talking about. But if you get a chance to stream any of these movies, you'll know who we're talking about.
I mean, you know, people don't realize they always like to look at stuff and go, oh, well, they were just trying to copy. No. And I'm going to get into another show about it. But we had other black producers out there during the 30s and 40s who made what they call race movies. That's what they called black movies back then. They were race movies. And Hollywood went out of their way to keep them out of the mainstream, to keep them from getting viewings. They had to come up with their own theaters, and, you know, they could only be shown in black communities.
Right.
But the funny thing about the black exploitation era was, and you know, like I know, because I know y'all spent nights at Sunset Drive-In on Fridays. If it wasn't for those actors and those directors, because this was the time when people like Fred Williamson and Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte, all these guys had their chances at directing. Bill Cosby.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the black exploitation era did. It opened up a lot of doors. But Gordon Parks was that cat. He filmed everything. He filmed from national parks to the inner cities of Chicago and New York to the oceans out here in California. And
he was a Renaissance man.
He's a Renaissance man. And his work was so classic, you can find it everywhere. If you Google Gordon Parks, go look at some of his work. And I'm gonna tell you, it'll do something to you. It'll grab you.
It'll knock your socks off. Those of us who are old enough to remember magazines like Look and Life, you will see some of his work in those. It's really poignant when you think about the shots that he took of northern tenements and things like that. The grittier side, yes. Powerful stuff. You're absolutely right, Brother Tony.
I can remember seeing some photos that he had taken, like, in the late 40s, early 50s for Life magazine of sharecropper work down in the South.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm telling you, it just grabs you. It makes you realize, you know, this really did go down like that.
Yeah. Yes, because photos don't lie. So
no, they don't. And it brings us right back to these battles that we are seeing about black history and what they call CRT and how certain areas like Florida and Texas and Arkansas are fighting to keep black history from being taught.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder why they're fighting so hard. Maybe they think that it's going to incite a rebellion. Gee, I wonder why that would happen. The truth,
you know, thing
is
if you claim you want to be honest and upfront and fair, then why fight to keep history from being taught? You're trying to make us look bad. No, you made yourself look bad by the things you did.
And continue to do.
and continue to do. I skimmed over an article today where Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida won't take interviews from MSNBC or NBC because he was upset by a question Andrea Mitchell asked him about Black history. But yet, you're down there barring Black history in your state, keeping Black history out of the schools, firing teachers because they won't get rid of certain books, or you're mad at them for speaking out on what you're doing.
It will, that sounds an awful lot like fascism to me. Sounds an awful lot like Nazi Germany to me.
Yeah, you hit it right on the head.
Yeah.
You hit it right on the head.
And this this is the dichotomy of America. It's always been hypocritical when it comes to freedom, free speech, and telling the truth, at least when it comes to people of color. So we've had, you know, people of color have had this, that whole doctrine of, what do they call it, doctrine of destiny or something like that?
Yes.
Destiny, all of
manifested
that.
Manifested destiny.
Yeah, so I can just claim, you know, whatever I say is the truth, and I'm claiming this land from these so-called savages. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, and this is a legacy that we live with in America, but the truth has got to come out, and all the people out there who are woke, I'm putting that in quotes, just keep pushing, never give up, because the truth is out there. And it must be taught, be sought out and taught.
Exactly.
So
it must be taught.
Yes, I'm so glad we're doing this show. You know, it's really brilliant of you to come up with the type of show where Black issues are talked about, whether they're local or national. So I'm just going to throw the number out there again. It is 563-999-3043. If y'all have something that you want to say about Black history and those who made it, please call in.
Yes, indeed. I'd like to hear from you. Now I'm going to give you another one. And this one here in California, some may have heard of her, some may not have. But this sister's name was Margaret Wright. She was a shipyard worker by day and an all-around political activist. Miss Wright ran for president in 1976 under the banner of the People's Party, and her running mate was Benjamin Spock, who had been the president, who had been the party's candidate in 1972. Now, their ticket was also endorsed by the Peace and Freedom Party and advertised her as a socialist for president. Miss Wright was also the founder and activist for women against racism in the Watts area of Los Angeles.
Okay, no. Wow. That's deep. That is now, I learned something about this sister.
Yes. Now, shipyard worker, I know where she was working. She was working at the shipyards in Long Beach. Because
wow, I bet she saw a lot down there.
At that time, there were a lot of military contracts and a lot of military vehicles being built at those shipyards.
Okay.
In fact, Long Beach had a military shipyard. It had a commercial shipyard. It had a military airfield, and it had a commercial airfield. My uncle, when he first came out this way, he would have been in electronics and military. He went to work for Southwest Airlines.
Okay.
And from Southwest, he got hooked up with United and Boeing. And then because of those jobs, he caught the eye of some folks he knew in the military. And he used to also work on the military side on different aircraft they were building, and one of the last aircraft he worked on was that new C-17 transport, and I actually got to accompany him to Edwards Air Force Base and take a ride on one of those bad boys on the test flight. That was a big deal, especially when we got up there and they opened up that back door and we're looking out over the desert. And, you know, I'm thinking, this is Edwards. And a lot of people don't realize Edwards Air Force Base is undercover Area 51.
Right.
Because there's been a lot of vehicles come up out of there that nobody has ever seen in their life. And that's the thing about being out on the desert. The military can do some testing that they normally can't do anywhere else.
Right.
And
right.
It may get seen, it may not get seen.
Right. Well, the American government is very, very good at keeping the down low about certain things. So.
And the other thing Edwards had claim to fame too was when our space shuttles first start coming back from outer space, and they didn't land at Kennedy. They land out there at Edwards on a dry lake bed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's,
yeah, I got to see a couple of them come in.
Wow.
That,
interesting.
That Borax, the Borax 20 mil team. That's kind of like the area where they would come in at.
Wow. Interesting. Very
remember
interesting.
The TV show? They used to have on where Death Valley Days.
Yeah, I love Death Valley Days.
And you would see the 20 mule team pulling the wagon. That's the same area that the space shuttle would land in.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I can see now that. With the next thing that I'm going to share, I don't know. Did you have more that you wanted to add on to that, Brother Tony?
No, go right ahead.
Okay. I was just going to say, and I had to chuckle. I was like, you know, the next little blurb, couple of blurbs that I'm going to throw out, well, the next one, has a military theme. And the one that I'm thinking about is Army Battalion 6888. And 6888 was an all-black unit of the Women's Army Corps, and it was it had 855 black women, both enlisted and officers, and they were led by Major Charity Adams. And the reason that I wanted to bring these sisters up is because, you know, the Army found out that they handled all the mail for the part that they were in France and England and stuff like that for our troops. And it was during that time that, you know, the officers, the higher ups, understood that if the men weren't getting any mail, that they were going to have low morale. So these sisters were in charge of making sure that the mail got through. And they were the only all-black, all-female battalion that was sent overseas during World War II. And the cool part about it is, and one of the reasons that I'm mentioning it, is that Tyler Perry is doing a movie right now about the 6888.
All right.
So, yeah, it's in production right now, so be on the lookout for it. Be on the lookout for it. So,
you know,
I just want to...
That's beautiful. That's beautiful because... We finally got Red Tails done properly, and now we're getting one about sisters who did put their time in the military. That's beautiful.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm looking forward to seeing this movie, and you know, people sometimes have problems with Tyler Perry, but Tyler Perry has put a lot of black people to work, both in front of and behind the camera. So I take my hat off to the brother, and I wish him well on this particular film journey. And I'm sure he's going to get the most of it told correctly, because that's the way it needs to be. So I've only got one more thing left, Brother Tony, but you go ahead and go, and I'll follow from you.
Okay. Well, tell you about Alexander Miles, an African-American inventor who was awarded a patent for elevator doors that open and close automatically.
Mm. Mm.
Okay. Now, everybody takes the elevator for granted. Push the button, elevator doors pop open, you get in.
Mm-hmm.
But once upon a time, elevator doors were operated manually.
Right.
And if that door wasn't closed properly, and if everything wasn't in place just right, that shaft remained open and people could lose their lives.
Yep, that was definitely a problem.
So Brother Miles came up with this invention that automatically opened and closed the doors for the elevator. That's U.S. patent 371,207, and it was awarded October 11th, 1887.
Wow.
This man was born in Pickaway County, Ohio, and then he moved to Waukesha, Wisconsin, where he earned a living as a barber. Now, he was married with three children, and it is said he got the idea for the elevator doors after his daughter fell into an open shaft and almost lost her life.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
That's what put him on the track to doing these elevator doors, and he worked at it for a while, but as you saw, he came through, got it patented, and got it invented. And Mr. Miles was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 2007 for his elevator doors.
That is some powerful stuff. That is some powerful stuff. And I had no idea that it was invented by a black man. You know, Brother Tony, I'm going to throw something out, and people might wonder, like, what is she doing even talking about this? But if this Brother Miles that Brother Tony has just told you about, if this is of interest to you, I think, and I just looked it up, think about reading this work of fiction. It was the 1999 debut work of Colson Whitehead, and it's called The Intuitionist, and it's all about elevators and who invented them and all of this stuff, and it's a powerful first work. I mean, he's published a lot since then, but my friend, check out The Intuitionist. So, you know, Brother Tony, when you brought up Brother Miles and the work that he's done, that just popped in my head, so I'm just throwing that out there. I mean, I didn't know that this fiction work was based on something that was actually done by a black man. So you have schooled me. Yes. You have schooled me. That's wonderful. That is wonderful. Well, I don't know how I'm going to come behind something like that. I'm just like, I only have one little blurb left, but did you have anything else you wanted to add about this, brother?
No, and I have a couple of more that I'm going to go to. So did you want to do yours now, or you want to save it for later, or what? How you want to do it?
No, I'll go ahead and do it now. It's a very small blurb, and it's about somebody who was born here in the Central Valley. This sister's name is Shirley Ann Williams, and Shirley was born in Bakersfield but raised in Fresno. She was a poet, a novelist, a professor, a vocalist, a playwright, and a social critic. She attended both Brown and Howard, but she graduated from CSU Fresno with a BA in English, and she got her master's. That's right. She got her master's at Brown. And her works include a novel called Desert Rose, which is a beautiful novel, a children's book called Working Cotton, a book of poetry called The Peacock Poems, and another novel called Girls Working Together. And she wrote an essay called Give Birth to Brightness. And I read that when I was in college, and it's very powerful. Shirley Ann, going back and forth a little bit, she graduated from Edison High School in 1962. And she grew up here. Her parents died. Her mom died when she was 16, and she and her oldest sister Ruby grew up in the projects over here on the west side. After she got her master's, she joined the faculty at UC San Diego in 1975, and she was the first Black female faculty member in the English department. And she worked there at UC San Diego until her passing, until her death in 1999. So for those people who, when they think of local talent, they think of William Sororian or the dude that wrote for Alvin and the Chipmunks, Ross Bagadarian. Think about Shirley Ann Williams. She was locally born and raised, and the sister had so much talent, just so much. Graduated from Edison, went to Fresno State, went to Brown and Howard, and taught English at UC San Diego. So I just wanted to throw that sister out there.
You know what? And I appreciate that because, you know, you said it, and then you said she, again, another tiger for life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And when you said that, it made me think about all of the talent that has passed through the very high school we went to.
Exactly.
Now, granted, a lot of it is athletic, but not all of it. We have our poets. We have our playwrights. We have our lawyers and doctors.
Yes, we do.
In fact, my classmate, Brother Jimmy Ricks, who I call very proudly and lovingly Brother X, he is right now serving in the field of medicine down there in the state of Georgia.
See?
Running a clinic and taking care of business.
And look at a brother like Arthur Cecil, who is a very fine painter.
Great painter.
You know, who has had his work hung in galleries. And so people have to understand that Southwest Fresno, and this is why I get so excited about West Side Visions, Southwest Fresno is a cultural hub for so many people who are Black and brown, and now, you know, in later years, in the 80s and so forth, Asian. There's a lot of talent that comes out of Southwest Fresno. A lot of talent.
Yes, indeed it is. And it may get looked over for a while, but it ain't going to get looked over all the time, because sooner or later, we're going to get to you and let folks know about you.
That's right. You know, that's right. That is absolutely right, Brother Tony. So.
Yep. Yes, indeed. And with that said, now I'm going to tell you about Azee Taylor Morton, Treasurer of the United States from September 12, 77 to January 20, 1981. And to my knowledge, the only African-American treasurer to ever hold the office. Her signature was printed on currency during her tenure. So not only did she serve, she got to sign her name to the money that went into circulation.
Okay. Wow.
Now, they all do not get to do that. Some of them come in during a time frame where that's already been taken care of, and they just served in the office. But she was there at the right time.
Mm.
Now, she was born.
Yeah. I was just going to say, there are no accidents in the universe, so it must have been the Almighty had a plan for her. So that's wonderful.
So she was born in a rural enclave called the St. John Colony in the farming community of Dale, Texas.
Mm.
She grew and worked as a teacher at the Crockett School for Girls, which in Texas was a state-sponsored school for delinquents. Now, before becoming treasurer, she served on President Kennedy's committee for equal employment and worked as an assistant to Robert Schwartz Strauss, who was the chair of the Democratic Party at the Democratic Committee at that time.
Mm.
And that was a big deal because, remember, this was late 60s, early 70s.
Right.
Very few black folks had a big time office in politics, and very few black women had any kind of office in politics. But now they were starting to come into their own.
Right.
And her serving as treasurer, that was a big deal.
She really worked her way up.
She worked her way up, and that was a big deal, her serving as treasurer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's cabinet level. That is a
exactly.
big deal.
Exactly. You hit that right on the head.
Yes.
Now, I don't know if I talked about this Brother Tuesday, but I'm going to talk about him again anyway.
Go ahead.
That would be Max Robinson. First African-American to anchor nightly news in 1978.
Oh, he's tough. Max Robinson was tough.
He got his start in 1959, reading the news at a station, at station WTOV in Portsmouth, Virginia, but was told he couldn't show his face. When he protested, he was fired.
Wow.
He then moved to Washington, D.C., became a reporter, and later co-anchored the evening news, making him the first black anchor in a major U.S. city. NBC took notice. ABC took notice and made him one of three co-anchors on World News Tonight. And he was also one of the 44 founders of the National Association of Black Journalists.
Yeah, he was.
And trust and believe, that was big time.
Yeah. Oh, that was huge. That was huge.
The NABJ.
I remember watching Max Robinson on TV.
Many of us do, because I know for myself, the first time I saw him, I was like, nah, not national. They playing with us. This is something that they just messing around with.
Yeah.
I came back the next evening, and there he was again, and I was like, okay, wait a minute. This must be the real deal. And that's when I started watching Brother Max Robinson. Now, in 1977, during the Hanoi siege in Washington, D.C., Max Robinson was the only news person that the perpetrators would speak with.
Gee, I wonder why that is, Brother Tony.
Those Islamic brothers said he was the only person they felt that they could trust.
See? Okay.
And
that speaks volumes.
A lot of networks were upset, and they tried to play it off as, oh, well, this is an inside thing. He got something to do with this. No, he didn't.
Mm.
But they had been following his career and felt like he was the only dude they could trust.
And this is one of the reasons why, optics is so important. Optics are important. It's important to have representation in, things like reporting and all of that. So, those perpetrators understood that if they wanted the truth and their story to get out, they had to talk to the right person. So, wow, that's something else. That is something else.
Not only did it show you the power of the media, but it showed you the power of certain people in the media.
Exactly. He certainly opened a lot of doors, that's for sure.
Yes, he did. And, we look at the way things are going down now. For example, those folks over there at Fox News and the madness that they put out there on the airwaves. Like you said, representation matters. This little piece of show that we do every Tuesday and Thursday, some may pay attention to it, some may not, but I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And it's not that I'm looking for any pats on the back. It's not that I'm looking for to be noticed. It's that I'm just going to put it out there on the line so that people can find out about our history. Some people don't know about their history. And, you know, what little we do, we're going to try to pass it on.
Well, you know, the thing that I like best about the show and why I was happy to be a part of it when asked is because we cover not just local, not just national, but international issues that have to do with people of the African diaspora. Now, and some people say, you know, all politics are local. That's the way I look at it. So when we talk about things and we talk about history, it's for a purpose. It's for a purpose. And I just remember something else that I read today, Brother Tony, and I'm going to get a chance to read it if I can before the show is over. But it's important what we do. Whether people want to hear about it or not, that's up to them. But at least the information is getting out. And history is so important. I was looking around at something today, and I was like, do you remember when I was sharing with you before, Brother Tony, about I got kicked out of school for saying the Black Panther Pledge? I actually found it today. And I didn't get to say all of it because I was stopped by a teacher before I got through all of it. But I actually found it today. So,
you know what, Sister Reed? Why don't you go on and put that pledge out there?
Okay. And, all right. Well, folks, this is the Black Child's Pledge, and it was created by another sister named Shirley Williams. It's not the same Shirley that I'm talking about. The spelling is different. And it was published in October 26, 1968. In the Black Panther, the newspaper of the Black Panthers. So here it goes, Black Child's Pledge. I pledge allegiance to my Black people. I pledge allegiance to develop my mind and body to be to the greatest extent possible. I will learn all that I can in order to give my best to my people in their struggle for liberation. I will keep myself physically fit, building a strong body, free from drugs and other substances that weaken me and make me less capable of protecting myself, family, and my Black brothers and sisters. I will unselfishly share my knowledge and understanding with them in order to bring about change more swiftly. I will discipline myself to direct my energies thoughtfully and constructively rather than wasting them in idle hatred. I will train myself never to hurt or allow others to harm my Black brothers and sisters. For I recognize that we need every Black man, woman, and child to be physically, mentally, and psychologically strong. These principles I pledge to practice daily and to teach them to others to unite my people. That, my friend, fellow listeners, was the Black Child's Pledge, first published in 1968 in the Black Panther newspaper.
Man, you just hit it on the money. And that's how we go in the night. That's how we go in the night.
All right.
And I got to give a shout out to some folks tonight that have been running our blog. And I'm very impressed by the fact that blacktwitterat.com, and this is separate from Twitter. It is called blacktwitterat.com, and I belong to them. But they have an area they call Spaces now, and our show is now on there.
Oh.
And I am very appreciative of that.
That's wonderful.
Sometimes you sit and wonder, is anybody paying attention? And that's, like I said, that's not why I do it. I do it because that's my way of giving back. But I really appreciate them for that.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have to do it. You know, they didn't have to do it, and I appreciate that. And today was Thursday, so I'm going to say again, those of you who may have a need, free AME, 806 Collins, from 11 to 1. Always have a grocery giveaway on Thursdays. And they help the entire community, not just the black community, the entire community. They will also have classes to help you get assistance on your utilities. So I will be bringing information about that also next Tuesday. Let you know how to take part in that. And again, I have no problem giving my flowers and giving shouts out, Pastor Harris and my Freedom School kids. Much love to you.
All right,
okay.
Now.
Sister Crystal Joyce, much love to you, because without my testimony, a whole lot of us wouldn't make it. And I know you praise hard, my sister, and you give it up for all of us, and we appreciate
it. Yes, she does. This is a sister who has got a passion for helping people and a passion with her faith. So, yes, indeed. Full shout out to Sister Crystal.
Yes, indeed. And we just gonna leave it right there. As always, Sister Reed, I appreciate you rolling with me. You have no idea how that make my heart feel. I appreciate it.
Ride or die, brother. That's how it be.
So with that, don't give me words, my sister.
Okay,
yeah,
we've
been rolling for a long time.
More than 40 years. So, yeah. So anyway, listeners, no, go ahead, Brother Tony. Go ahead.
No, I was getting ready to say, ain't too many folks, you know, that can say that they is a Carver Eagle, a Earl Cub, and an Edison Tiger. We got that slated.
Yep, we do. We do. There are a few of us around, but not a whole lot. Not a whole lot.
Exactly. There are a few of us around, but not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot. So, no, you're absolutely right. And I treasure that. You know, I don't take it for granted. I think a lot of times, you know, and this is not a slam to young people. When you're young, you think you have all the time in the world to get something done. When, in fact, when you get older, you start seeing, you know, things a little bit different. I've got more years behind me than I've got in front of me, but that's okay. You know, that's okay. As long as I can keep doing the things that I'm doing that I think make even just a little tiny little bit of a difference, I'm going to keep on doing it. So,
amen.
Yeah. Amen. So, all right. Well, I'm going to say my little bit to all y'all. I love you. And please, please, please stay black until we get back.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And like I always say, each one, reach one, teach one, those of you who are proficient with your arms, take your folks to the range, get them trained up, start a neighborhood watch, start a cop watch, watch the people who are watching us. Take care of your folks. Make sure you watch out for them, that they're learning things. Teach your young ones pride in their history. I'm thankful for all of y'all because, like Sister Reed said, we have more years behind us than we have in front of us. But while we're here, we're going to make sure we get it done. Everybody take care of one another. We'll holler.